Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning is former ABC7 political reporter Charles Thomas. Charles, thanks for joining us again.
Hey, good morning, my friend. Good to be back.
We're on the cusp of Memorial Day weekend, of course, where we remember our war dead. We're hoping that we won't have to be, I mean, I don't mean to make a joke of it, we're hoping that we won't have to be memorializing any more dead civilians, that is, on the streets of Chicago this weekend. So that was the point of BLM Brandon's presser yesterday with a phalanx of city staff and social service providers and a few police. And he said, you know, we're going to keep the kids busy, Charles. We've got all kinds of activities planned. We've got 200 and some odd community organizations that are going to be putting together barbecues and three-legged races and all that fun stuff. And of course, that's on top of the peacekeepers that Governor Pritzker has deployed to Chicago, sounding very much like we're sort of some third world warlordocracy. Peacekeepers being deployed to Chicago, that's something we normally associate with the UN and third world warlordocracies, but now we associate with Chicago. What's your reaction to what the mayor has done in his first week or so in office, and what you think his approach to this weekend and to crime in general is?
I think I think it could cool out some of the silly kids that he talked about a month ago.
Silly kids.
But you got to understand that there's more than just silly kids out there. I mean, the four suspects in the Arianna Preston murder, police officer murdered at the end of her shift, those were teenagers too. And those weren't silly kids. Those were hardened criminals. And how is he going to deal with, you know, this wave of robbery crews that have now spread out around the city, and they're in all neighborhoods, by the way, and they're committing some of the worst, most violent crimes you can imagine, and they, for the most part, are teenagers and young men. And I don't know that any news conference at 63rd Street Beach that they had yesterday is going to really relate to those guys, because those are the people who are the big problem, the huge problem. I don't have any doubt that they'll be able to keep the lid on things around Millennium Park this weekend, because they're going to have very focused police coverage there for these 3 days. But in the rest of the city, the robbery crews that are running amok in the city, and I'm not exaggerating, what do they have to do? How are they going to deal with that?
Well, look at the mindset that you're dealing with here. How about that brawl at O'Hare Airport?
Oh.
I mean, are there more secure facilities that with heavier police and law enforcement presence than airports? Are there harder targets than airports? And yet a bunch of silly kids get into this fight. I mean, we're talking about dozens sprawling all over some part of the baggage claim area at O'Hare. I mean, the mentality of doing that at O'Hare Airport, at an airport where you know there is law enforcement everywhere, that just speaks to a fundamental indifference to the rule of law, to law enforcement, and a complete lack of fear and respect for any of the above.
Well, when I grew up, they called it home training. They called it home training, and that was what your parents taught you how to comport yourself in public. And everybody had it. Everybody knows what I'm talking about when I say home training.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, you're just not getting that in many homes. And I'll say it because I can. African-American homes. Right now we have a situation where 75 to 80% of black children are growing up in single-parent households. And they are not getting the quote-unquote home training that they used to get when I was coming up in the game. I mean, it's just not there anymore. And we're not – and as much as Brandon talks about the root causes that he wants to attack, I don't see any programs yet that are addressing that root cause, because that is a huge root cause, which is restoring the black family. And that isn't happening. We're not hearing that. That conversation isn't happening.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Now, from the Signature Bank Studios, this is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning is Charles Thomas, former ABC7 political reporter. We were talking about BLM Brandon's plan to keep the silly kids busy this weekend, his plan for public safety this Memorial Day weekend. That's a plan that needs to be, I think, sketched out, not weekend by weekend, but more globally. But nevertheless, I digress. Here is what he said at his presser yesterday about deploying all these community organizations and social service providers.
This is not just simply a strategy around policing. You have a collaboration of individuals who are committed to making sure that there's activity in Chicago.
Yeah, activities. You just need some water balloon tosses and, egg runs and things like that, and we should quell the gang violence, gang-related violence in Chicago. That seems to be what he and his allies believe. Charles, I direct your attention to this report that was issued shortly after he was inaugurated. I'm talking about Mayor Johnson. And this is a report that was issued by his allies, specifically the Action Center on Race and the Economy, ACRE.
Mm-hmm.
On the board of ACRE is one CTU president, Stacey Davis Gates.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So let's not pretend that these are not fellow travelers, political allies. They're as close an ally as you can have. Stacey Davis Gates, in case anybody's forgotten, was, on stage introducing Brandon Johnson on election night to celebrate his victory. The report says, here's what Chicago needs. First we get the money, though, is the name of the report. I mean, could they be any more brazen? I tell you what, I appreciate it.
I do, too. I think it's great.
Don't couch it. This is Scarface stuff. And I concede your point. $12 billion in new spending is what will make Chicago truly safe. $12 billion.
Let's go back just briefly, very briefly, to yesterday and the announcement that they had $3.5 million to spread among 250-some community organizations to
sprinkle the infield.
Yeah, that's $14,000. That's an average. I just did the math. $14,000 for each group on average. I don't really know how much that's going to do, but this business of first we get the money, I loved it because it set up the battle lines within the Brandon Johnson administration, and it set this goal of $12 billion in new spending when, in fact, they probably are looking for more, something more in the neighborhood of I don't know, but he talked about $800 million in his campaign.
Well, you know, you do it a few steps at a time, I presume. But I mean, so when they, for example, some of the proposals, just to give you a flavor, a head tax on business of $33 per employee. When the head tax on employees in Chicago was repealed, it was $4 per employee. Mm. So think about a 8x increase in the head tax over, well, I mean, since it doesn't exist, it'd be more than that, but over what it previously was. That gives you a flavor for what we're talking about. Raising the real estate transfer tax on sales over $1 million by about 125%. Actually, a little bit more than that, more like 150%. There's just some others here. Tax on financial and business assets of the 10th wealthiest Chicagoans. They want Illinois to change the state law to allow that. That would be unconstitutional. But again, you know, what's
the income tax in there somewhere?
Sure. The 3.5% income tax on incomes over $100,000. Also this, get rid of the police gang database in favor of a peace book, which would inform communities about peacekeepers, violence interrupters, mediators, circle keepers, and restorative justice practitioners. One big drum circle, the city of Chicago will be. Eliminate the 1,000 vacant police positions. Actually, I think it's more like 2,000, but okay. And commit to cutting the police department budget before cutting other services.
You know, it's almost as though they're trying to make Chicago San Francisco Midwest. Well, I mean, they've got to go a ways to get this. After they get the money, then they will certainly change the entire look of the city.
Well, and I wanted to mention this because we had a conversation offline, off air, when his transition team was announced, and I remember talking to you about it. And you were startled by the names that were included as sort of senior level people in that transition team. You thought it told you a lot about where this administration would go, any attempts to sort of moderate his positioning notwithstanding.
Well, I'm not going to use any names, but yeah. I will say that 10 years ago, some of the names you really had to stretch. You had to stretch with your editor. Can I use this soundbite from this person? Well, that person, the editor would say, that person doesn't have any constituency. They're way out there on the fringe. Why would you do that? Aren't there other people you could? And some of those people are on the transition team right now. I mean, they are major players now. I mean, that have moved into the mainstream, if you will, not ideologically, but certainly in terms of the government. They are now in positions where what they believe will be implemented.
And yeah, the leftist fringe has become the establishment in Chicago.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's the same way it was in San Francisco when you had people like, was it Chesa Boudin who became the state's attorney? I mean, Chesa Boudin, he was like way out there on the weatherman, way left fringe. And he became the state's attorney in San Francisco. But I think we've got that. A similar situation here.
Well, if we can make weathermen like Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers tenured professors, then San Francisco can make one a prosecutor, I suppose.
Mm, I suppose.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Nick, Northwest Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, thank you. And I want to say thank you for having such a great guest there. Both of you guys know what's going on, I'm telling you. That's why I keep listening to your show, Dan. I am living history of what's been going on with the schools and these young black kids going, I'm a white guy, I'm a conservative guy, I'm not a Nazi or Ku Klux Klan, I'm just I am a Trump supporter, though, so that automatically makes me evil. But anyhow, I grew up seeing with the kids from Cabrini Green Housing Project going to school and the schools that I went to, especially in high school in the mid-60s when I was in my mid-teens. They used to talk about, like, these kids aren't getting educated too well. What's going to happen to them when they go out looking for a job and trying to find a job and trying to keep a job? And it was obvious that there are going to be problems. I saw that then clearly. And the problem is that when the teachers go on to one of their little strikes, sometimes one of the deals they get set up properly for themselves is their pension plan. Well, sometimes it's 20, 30 years later, got it all worked out. In the meantime, grade by grade, year by year, these young black kids are being graduated, poorly educated. We know the statistics do not confirm what the grades are that they're given, which will look good as a result, you know, showing that they got things done with the teaching. The teachers did not get things done. And then you have the other problem, the single parent scenario. I'm not condemning. Most of them are women who are single parents. I'm not condemning all the women, but when you have a little boy growing up, a little black boy growing up in the inner cities, he starts going out and seeing the glory of the guys driving around in cars with guns, got money, got girlfriends, and they start seeing that as the lifestyle that looks really desirable to them. And then the funding for schools and all, everything's always funding, everything's always money. The lottery was going to solve all the problems. And I remember when they came out with it, and there's never enough money because they're not doing the right thing to begin with. So
yeah.
I know your guest there knows what's going on as well as you do. You're two outstanding people together on the same show.
Thank you for taking my call. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Nick. Appreciate that. Another piece of this, Charles, is becoming more pronounced this week and recently is the situation with providing city resources for migrants and continuing to be a sanctuary city, and the latest development being allowing the children of migrants to enroll in CPS schools. That's number one. And number two, allowing them to do so without having to abide the same requirements as Chicago residents, as families in these in these neighborhoods that go to these particular schools. For example, vaccination requirements. Those were waived for the children of migrants and imposed on families in Chicago. How does that square with you?
Well, I mean, the Chicago Public Schools, their enrollment has dropped dramatically over the last 5 to 10 years. I mean, what is it now? Only like 300-some thousand children in Chicago Public Schools?
If you believe even that many, right?
It probably isn't that many. That's how many they claim. They need bodies. The Chicago Teachers Union needs bodies right now in order to maintain their what they're doing in the schools. I didn't say scam, but they need bodies because the Chicago Public Schools are dying their own slow death of their own doing, and they need it. I mean it's been said for years that the whole migration thing, immigrant thing, is to somehow solidify or consolidate the Democratic Party's power in this country. That's why they're letting in 5-7 million people during the Biden years, because they ultimately want to have a huge amnesty program, which would allow these people to become voters. And the Democrats are assuming they're going to be Democratic voters.
Well, and here's the thing. Now, you're getting reaction from minority communities, particularly black residents of black neighborhoods, like we saw in South Shore with protestations over using the former South Shore High School as a migrant center. You have a mom told Fox News, a CPS mom, right now in the school district in which we live, we have to provide residency, citizenship, health records, and vaccination records almost on an annual basis. I have a child right now, and I must have 5 emails in my inbox stating my child cannot return to school next year without a specific vaccine. All that is waived for the children of migrants.
And, you know, black Chicagoans and black people around the country are being sold a complete bill of goods on this, on everything. I mean, they are being manipulated like you would never, like I don't think any group has ever been manipulated, and they're getting nothing, nothing for it. And, you know, it takes me to this thing that happened earlier this week where the NAACP sent out an edict that said black people should not travel to Florida.
Right.
Or that Florida was an inhospitable place for black people. Well, you know, the Economic Policy Institute, which publishes unemployment figures every 3 months, every quarter, they reported that Florida has a 3.8% unemployment, black unemployment rate. Contrast that to Illinois, which has a 10.9% unemployment rate. Now, the Economic Policy Institute, these are liberal, left, way left of center of people. A liberal think tank established and funded by organized labor. They're saying Illinois has a 10.9% unemployment rate, the highest in the country, and Florida has a 3.8% unemployment rate, one of the lowest in the country, certainly the lowest of the big states. So, and yet, now the NAACP is telling me not to go to Florida?
Yeah.
That's where the jobs are, according to if you're black.
I mean, not to mention that's where the black-owned businesses are, number one in the country in black-owned businesses.
Absolutely. So they're telling you this stuff basically at the behest of the Democrat Party, and we're buying it. We're getting hung up on stuff like CRT and other, you know, esoteric issues, and we're not dealing with the reality. You got to have jobs in America. In Florida, you can get a job. In Illinois, you can't if you're a black person. It's tough, tougher.
Well, you have to wait for the Johnson administration to come up with the cash to just give everybody jobs on an annualized basis. Like, I can't imagine what those jobs are going to be. But that's the program. Everything runs through the government here.
Yeah.
Everything runs through the government.
But we're falling for it. Black folks have fallen for it. But I think slowly but surely, I mean, people are, I mean, I think that's a lot of this whole reparations business.
Yeah.
That speaks of desperation on the part of the Democrat Party. Here you have a problem with the debt ceiling that's consuming Washington. And they're talking about trillions of dollars in reparations. That isn't going to happen. But the Democrats will use that as a lever in 2024 because they'll have all their congressional candidates come out and say, oh, I'm for reparations. I'm for, like, knowing they'll never, never, never get them or do it. But they can say it because the Republicans will say, no, it doesn't make sense. Well, so we'll fall for it.
Well, since you brought it up, I want to get your reaction just on that quick tangent because it's related. They're all intertwined. To what Bob Woodson said about reparations and the move for reparations in big urban centers around the country and blue states like California and the People's Republic of Evanston. Bob Woodson on the Dr. Phil Show, part of a group that discussed reparations. Take a listen.
There were about 3,700 free blacks who owned 12,000 slaves, black slaves. The question is, do the descendants of those free blacks who owned black slaves, do they pay? Blacks really benefited more the first 100 years after slavery we have in the last 50 years. I was born in 1937 during the Depression. Everyone in my small, low-income black community, 98% of the households had a man and a woman raising children. Elderly people could walk safely in that community without fear of being assaulted by their grandchildren. Never heard of gunfire during that time. Never heard of a child being shot to death in the crib. But there are 50 children today who have been shot and killed in our cities. You're talking about remedies. We've got to look beyond saying that every solution has to have a winner and a loser, that blacks can only benefit if whites lose. We have to be defined more than just victims of oppression.
What do you think, Charles?
Well, yeah, I think he speaks of one of the very complicated factors involving the whole reparations argument. California, where they passed this bill that really has no dollars involved in it yet, but they passed this bill in California, and California was not a slave state.
Right.
Come on. I mean, so we're talking about all that money for what happened. And in fact, California was a place that many free blacks they traveled there because and reestablished their residency there because it was not Arkansas or Mississippi or Alabama. They actually went there looking for something better, and the fact is they found something better. They certainly found something better. But then you have the whole interracial marriage situation. I mean, do you pay Patrick Mahomes the same as you pay somebody else? I mean, or somebody who's interracial?
Yeah, are we going to means test it? You know, Bob Johnson, the founder of BET, and you know, a billionaire. I mean, is he in line for whatever $400,000, $2 million, whatever the number is?
Dan, check this out. One of the most sordid vestiges of chattel slavery was the whole one drop theory. You have one drop of black blood in you, you're suddenly black.
Right.
I mean, it is horrific. The fact that white slave owners could enslave their own children, their own biological children. I mean, that's horrible stuff. But today, people are using the one drop theory as a way for me to get, reparations, somebody like myself, even to get reparations. I can trace my family back to white people. not in four or five generations, but am I to get reparations at the same rate someone who didn't have that family history? It's ridiculous.
Well, those are questions. And by the way, those are questions for BLM Brandon, too, because he's already convened these town halls on reparations.
Absolutely.
Last week.
Oh, they're going to do it for 2024. I mean, the Democrats are going to do it all over the country because, again, it's going to be another scam that they use to manipulate the black vote. That's what this is about. I hope people understand. It should be about jobs and economy, but no, it's about stuff like reparations.
And Chris, sorry to interrupt, but Chris on I-65, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I hear people say all the time, you know, they're not getting anything for it. And I know what you're trying to say, but they get millions of dollars from government through government funded programs and initiatives as a way to, I think, as you just properly said, continue to run that scam. So, you know, the Chicago area mega churches and organizations and all those things get, I don't want to say bought off, but they get a lot of money through government programs to perpetuate the system that you're describing.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Well, I think there's a difference. I mean, you know, there are race hustlers out there, and there are people that get a lot of cash from government programs to run organizations. A lot of it's just to do politics, like thinly veiled as community service organizations, but their real mission is politics. But I think what you're talking about, Charles, correct me if I'm wrong, are the people who have essentially given up their individual sovereignty, their dependence of the state. They're not making a lot of money, but, you know, it's a bird in the hand kind of situation.
Well, they're being manipulated, bottom line. I mean, that's to me. They're being manipulated with these phony issues that and they're not dealing with the real issues, the real issues that can make a difference in their communities. They're not dealing with those at all. They're just basically falling in line to the Democrat Party's wishes, and they're being manipulated.
George in Naperville.
Yeah, are the new migrants going to be included in all these fun activities? Are they going to have culturally appropriate things for them to do, like pinatas and all that fun stuff?
Well, George, we are a welcoming city, so of course they'll be included. Matt, Mount Greenwood.
I'm leaving early
today,
man.
But... Hey, Matt.
Hello.
Hey, Matt. Oh, all right. We lost Matt. Dan and Charles in for Amy on this edition of Chicago's Morning Answer.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning is former ABC 7 political reporter Charles Thomas. Charles, the Invest in Kids K through 12 tax credit scholarship program is no more.
Ah, man, isn't that horrible? Wow, I mean, it's not only is it a blow to the young people who were taking advantage of the program, but I think the whole school choice movement in Illinois takes a step back, particularly in where in Chicago you see the Chicago Teachers Union member being elected mayor, and that the union's profile having been raised so much by that event. But but you can't give up. You got to keep after it. And I think people who again are, I go right back to it, black people have to understand that school choice is something from which they can benefit. They look at their schools and see the condition of their schools, and something's got to change. And school choice would provide the kind of pressure that's needed on the public schools to improve.
There were some black families and many black families, in fact, and many Hispanic families that benefited from the program. They represent about half of the, a little bit more than half of the 9,348 scholarships that are in force at present, and the plurality are whites. The rest of the scholarship recipients are white families with white kids. And that was a problem for the teachers' union.
Well, of course, because they play the race card. That's how they manipulate black voters.
But I just so the 1,365 black families with a kid on scholarship going to a better school than the neighborhood school, per the decision of his or her parents.
Mm-hmm.
The 2,280 Hispanic families doing the same.
Mm-hmm.
They don't matter, because you have 4,300 white families that are benefiting. That makes sense?
Well, it's par for the course. It's what they do. And the fact that they make an issue of it to destroy the entire program is again, par for the course. It's what they do. They use race to manipulate the situation. I mean, but I think people are finally wising up to it. Because I think you have that many more allies among those Latino and black families who will find the program doesn't exist anymore, and they'll have to go back to those underperforming public schools. I mean, you only get one chance to do third grade, man.
Mm-hmm.
You only get one chance, and these parents know that. They can't wait for the Chicago public schools to improve. I mean, no, who can wait for that? What, 5-10 years? That's under ideal situations. They keep saying they're getting better, when they haven't gotten better. In fact, they've gotten worse.
And again, we're talking about low-income families. I just want to make clear that racial distribution, I just told you because, and I'm telling you that, as I told you yesterday, because the teachers' unions and the new Marxists in charge of the city and the state are fomenting or trying to foment a race war as best they can. That's what they're doing, unequivocally. And you're talking about low-income families, depending on the region, $35,000 to $45,000 is the median household income. And there's no set aside. There's no magic number. Here's how many scholarships for Black, Latino, White. It's just based on, you know, families that apply. That's
right,
all.
Right.
And nobody in the school choice movement cares if it's 70% Black and 15% White and 50% Latino or some other combination. We don't care. That's not the point. The point is low income families similarly situated, regardless of race, that want the same opportunities for their kids as the rich and the politically connected have. That's it. Simple proposition.
Yeah, I've it's interesting. I don't know where the mayor is sending his kids to school. That's a good question.
He's CPS. But
CPS all the way for his son?
I believe so.
And what about the union leaders?
Well, that's a different story.
I've heard things.
And what about the union members? I mean, half of CPS teachers send their kids to private schools.
Right.
As I've often said,
I've heard
what do they know
about the union leaders?
Yeah. Well, how about the
private school?
How about the politicians that killed it?
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Chris Welch is the House Speaker.
Mm-hmm.
He sends his kid to Timothy Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Lutheran school, private Lutheran school. So behind the scenes, once the taxpayer scholarship, it was announced the other day, when they announced their budget deal, Pritzker, Harmon, the Senate president, and Welch, that TCS, the taxpayer scholarship, is not included in the budget. And then over the last 24 hours, there was a lot of machinations to try to get TCS included. I know because I was involved in those conversations, talking to Republican legislators and you know others in the school choice movement in Illinois, other proponents of these tax credit scholarships. There was a deal proposed that if you put Republican votes on this awful budget that the Democrat socialists have passed or have agreed to, the framework they agreed to, you know, with the billions and aid for people in this country and in the state illegally and so forth, spending money, you know, well beyond our means without addressing sucking chest wounds like the unfunded pension obligations, you know, the typical budgets that we've seen over the last 25 years, just another version of that. And it, with as with each previous year, it just gets more and more ridiculous. So you put Republican votes in the House and the Senate on this awful budget so that we can claim it's bipartisan and we'll include it. We'll include an extension of TCS. Don Harmon, the Senate president, St. Ignatius, for his kid, he is a socialist and I don't much care for him. But I believe he was actually negotiating in good faith that he would do this deal. And then it came back, well, we'll do the deal, but there's two issues. One, we're going to scale the program down. Instead of $75 million you can raise a year, it'll be 50. We're going to tier the tax credits based on amount of gifts. So, you know, because we need to be seen as, you know, socking it to those millionaires and billionaires, which really makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Sock it to millionaires and billionaires who are going to give more money for the tax credits into the program to provide more scholarships. But this is the thinking of the left. So this is who you're dealing with. OK, so that's so we're going to scale it down and in sort of these component parts. Those are the top lines. There's some other things, but those are the top lines. OK, fine with that. I was fine with that. I encouraged Senate Republicans to support that deal. But the problem was in the House. The problem is that Chris Welch and you know, the report was, I didn't talk to him. He doesn't really care for me. Governor Pritzker, the report was that Governor Pritzker, he was going to do anything to lift a finger. He wasn't going to engage on it, but he was fine with it. You want to cut that deal, you cut that deal. Problem was in the House. Chris Welch didn't have the votes. And, I mean, he's got, you know, he's got 78 members, so he technically has the votes, but he couldn't get his caucus together. Or he couldn't get his caucus together such that he feared there would be revolts coming from the Black caucus and the Latino caucus.
Is that a cover story or what?
Well, I mean, does he want to kill it? Do they all want to kill it in service of the teachers' unions?
Yeah.
Of course they do.
Yeah, that's a deal.
Of course, but would they do this deal so they have this veneer of bipartisanship that they can run around and take credit for so that you know, further marginalize an opposition party that doesn't even exist anyway? So I don't know why this was so important to them, but it appeared to be. And Harmon was willing to do the deal on that basis. Welch never got it together, and then it started to come down and down and down. Oh, you know, maybe we could do we'll extend it for 6 months and give you a 1 year extension on the sunset, and we'll put together a group to study the issue to make it a turn. So he just kept coming down and down and down, and there was never any good faith by Welch, because here's the problem. And this is what I'm. And so this is the backstory. Just so you know, for all the leftists you hear talking about extortionary politics at the federal level over the debt ceiling, Here's extortionary politics. We're killing scholarships for kids unless you give us Republican votes that we wouldn't otherwise have, so we can buffalo the public into believing this was bipartisan.
So bottom line is there will be no scholarship program.
No, there wasn't included in the budget implementation deal. And so, no, I mean, you'll have people say, oh, well, we can pick it up in the fall and veto session. Come on. That requires 3/5 supermajority votes to pass anything. It's not happening. So there's a couple of things here. I just wanted to give people the backstory so you understand how things actually work. And there's some people on our side that said, I wouldn't make that deal. This is the same sort of deal we made with the tax credit scholarship program 5 years ago, and we had to swallow a bunch of bad stuff that is hard to unwind, and we never get to a true sort of landscape for that could potentially foment a conservative reform revolt in this state if we continue to deal from a position of weakness. But my point was, we are in a position of weakness. Let's recognize where we are and the leverage we don't have. We are in the super minority, and this is the only positive public policy that Illinois has implemented that I can think of in the last 3 decades. And also, you got 9,000 kids on scholarship, and we can't just walk away from them, number one. Number two, if you did get the 5-year extension, you have the ability then to raise tens, hundreds of millions of more dollars to provide tens of thousands of more scholarships and build a much bigger constituency that hopefully would be more animated than this constituency was. And I'm not really blaming the parents so much as I am blaming Empower Illinois and the self-styled diplomats at Empower Illinois who think that getting beaten up in a back alley and begging for tax credit scholarships is the way to deal with these movement Marxists who want to kill the program in service of the teachers' unions. They fundamentally misunderstand the landscape, and that's one of the big points. They could have imposed a cost. They could have imposed a cost by not sending parents down to Springfield to walk around the hallways and get shined on by disingenuous legislators, but by telling their stories and amplifying their stories. That's the way you do it, by organizing these families to speak with one voice publicly in front of cameras on social media. That some rich white lady at the IEA is going to take away my kid's scholarship. Some rich legislator who gets to send his kids to private schools, the best private schools, is going to take away my kid's scholarship. That's the kind of conversation we need. But that's too confrontational for the Cardinal. And that's too confrontational for Juan Rand Hell, who's the political guru over at Empower Illinois. And he just got a nice trifecta going. First, he cratered the UNO. You remember the UNO charter schools? Right. Then he was the one of the architects behind the wonderful Paul Vallis campaign. And now he's the political strategist for Anthony Holter at Empower Illinois, who just completely misplayed this deal when it comes to dealing with the Welches and the Harmons and the Pritzkers of the world.
Have you seen very much coverage of this situation in the mainstream
media?
I know. The thing is that I've
the Democrats are smothering it with the pillow, and so the media is saying, okay, well, we can't cover that. We're not allowed to cover that.
The media is right there with them. I mean, I don't want to get off the subject, but during this budget conversation that's going on right now, Illinois, have you heard very much about the pension situation? And remember, that was in the paper almost every day 5-6 years ago.
Nobody cares.
Nobody cares. And right now, it is nothing. As you say, it's a sucking chest wound in the state, but you never hear a word about it anymore.
Because there's no opposition party, and because the Chicago and Springfield Press Corps are the comm shops of the Democrat Socialist Party.
Absolutely.
It's just that simple. So where are you going to hear from it other than, you know, the papers with which I'm affiliated and this program? That's it.
I'd like to know what the situation is right now. I'd really like to know that.
I mean, it's the numbers are so astronomical. You know, take the believe whichever actuary you want, from $160 to $250 to $320 billion in unfunded liabilities. The bottom line is, and starting in Chicago, these pension funds are circling the drain. And if you're under the age of 45, I wouldn't count on those pensions being there for you, at least not at the levels that they're being promised. But I want to get back to TCS.
Yeah, go for it.
Maybe because one of the things here, this is just a lesson of politics. When you're dealing with the disingenuous race hustling hacks like Chris Welch, if you don't impose a cost, they will. If you don't impose a cost, they will. And the problem with the center right folks in this state, and it's been that way for a long time, is we're afraid to impose costs. We're afraid to go to the mat. We're afraid to take it to the street. We will not impose costs. We will be bought off. We will make excuses. We will beg. We will not impose costs. Well, this is how you marginalize yourself to irrelevancy, which is what we've done. The second thing here is, and I'm just going to speak unvarnished about this, as we were talking about what afflicts minority communities in a most pronounced fashion, but it's across the racial spectrum now when we talk about fatherless homes and things like that, the lack of job opportunities for lower income people, for those who didn't get a quality education. It cratered in the House, the Black and Latino caucuses in the House. And here's what nobody will say. Black legislators, even those who voice support for school choice and for this program like Curtis Tarver, the teachers union is a jobs program for the Black community and to a lesser extent the Latino community. It's a jobs program, and they are not going to put kids' education ahead of their jobs. That's just the culture. And the Latino caucus, and I've said this before, but I'll say it again in this context. The Latino caucus, Latinos, you know, the gap between Republicans and Democrats when it comes to Latinos continues to shrink. That's true at the national level. But here in Chicago, the Latino caucus in the city council and the Latino caucus in Springfield are full of Che Guevaras. These are ideological Marxists, and you throw in a couple of transactional hacks who just want a title and want to pretend, walk around town pretending to be someone like Lisa Hernandez from Cicero. That's your caucus. So you can tell me about the Latino electorate, but you have to look at the caucus. And this is what those caucuses did, despite the fact that the tax credit scholarships are overwhelmingly popular based on polling. We talked about yesterday, the Wall Street Journal had an editorial that mentioned it as well. You know, 60% and 70% support among minority voters for the tax credit scholarship program. But these legislators are not afraid of their constituents because they won't impose a cost. Just like the Republican Party won't impose a cost. You don't impose a cost. They will impose a cost. You talk about, Democrats take you for granted when people make that, you know, it's Ice Cube. It's a bad play for us to just be on 95% aligned with Democrats because they take us for granted and Republicans don't even try. Your individual legislators, your individual legislators. That's where it's at.
That's true. That's true. Your individual legislators do take you for granted, and they feel covered by the party. Without a doubt, that's one reason they do, because they know that they're covered by the party.
James and Joliet. Yeah, go ahead, James.
Yeah. Hey, for security reasons, I won't say the exact name, but the school that his kids go to in Chicago is it's a magnet school. And the reason I know is my daughter works there, and they just got an extra security guard for that. But, yeah, kind of rich, isn't it, that the former teacher that liked to not ever fail a student and never gave homework sends his kids to a school for those that get a choice. Anyway, that's all I have to say.
Thanks for the call, James. Well, it doesn't surprise me. Although we'll see how magnet schools are when Brandon Johnson and the CTU get done with him by the end of his first term, because I suspect that those magnet schools are going to lose their magnetism through elimination of entrance exams and through sort of equitizing the composition of the student bodies. That's what I suspect is happening, because the teachers' unions, I mean, they really despise kids on scholarship. They really despise the church, for example. Thus, Kwame Raoul's report sawing sawdust on the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal 24 hours before the General Assembly returned to Springfield to address the budget and the future of the TCS program, the Tax Credit Scholarship Program. You think that was coincidental?
Mm. Mm.
But we'll see. We'll see the fate of those magnet schools. But your point is well taken. Thanks for the call, James. Bill, LaSalle County.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. One of the ways we can beat this mainstream media collusion is let's start buying up the media companies. Right now, the market cap for WGN's parent and Sinclair Broadcasting is below $10 billion. There's got to be enough money among conservatives and conservative millionaires, billionaires, that we can just start buying these companies on the cheap, especially print media, because nobody's buying newspapers anyway.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Dan and Charles Thomas in for Amy J. Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Now, from the Signature Bank Studios, this is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning is former ABC 7 political reporter Charles Thomas. Before we get to the IRS whistleblower, I got an email. Dan, I don't understand what you mean when you say Republicans will not impose costs. Are you talking about only political costs? How can costs be imposed when in much of the state conservatives are outnumbered, the population of the state has a decreasing number of children? I give an example, but I just want, for clarity's sake, I'll repeat. In the context of the tax credit scholarships, how do you impose a cost? You bring families that are beneficiaries out into the public arena. We had one of the dads who's from Little Village on the show, Jerry Valdivia. You bring them out. You prosecute their cases. You make credible, pointed accusations against disingenuous politicians, like I just said. You get to send your kid to a better school than the neighborhood school, but I don't. Some rich white lady is going to tell this lower-income black family where they can send their kids and where they can't to school. You're going to take away money that was donated to help my child get a better education and have a better life? The hell you are. All of these battles need to be fought out in public, not behind closed doors where people pretend that they're negotiating. And that's what the school choice sort of establishment chose to do to their detriment. And it's what the center right always does in this state. An unwillingness to impose political costs, an unwillingness to make it uncomfortable for state legislators to do the wrong thing, to put their interests ahead of the interests of their constituents. Is that so complicated? What, since we understand that most politicians are hacks that are mostly interested in their reelection, if they're mostly interested in reelection and you understand their motivation, then what they that they look through every issue through the prism of, does this help me or hurt me get reelected? Then what do you think animates them? Pressure. Protest.
Dan.
Costs.
Dan. You know, having worked in mainstream newsrooms for a long time, it's difficult to get them to listen, to basically air your grievance, because they are so co-opted by the powers that be, they won't do the story.
Well, I agree with you. But the landscape is better. Not because the media is any better, but because you have social media, because you have all these platforms to tell stories. I mean, the people backing this program, the money that these people have, there should have been a public campaign. You can buy time too.
Absolutely,
there's money to buy time.
Got to buy the time.
But you can buy the time on traditional TV, radio.
Sure.
Billboards.
Yeah.
I mean, like a political campaign,
right.
You know,
right.
Pressure.
Right. But doing a news conference that you know, these
that in
people
of itself is
cover.
Not enough.
Not
no, that
enough.
In of itself is not enough. But telling stories, people share them. People, you have to be a storyteller with a point. And this point is couldn't be more straightforward. And the families couldn't be more sympathetic. And in some cases, heroic. What they're doing to try to get a better education, access to a better education for their kids. You think people aren't interested in those stories? Maybe the Chicago Press Corps isn't, but regular human beings are.
Absolutely.
But you have to be willing to tell them.
But you got to buy it. You got to buy the time. You got to buy the time to,
I mean, it's
to
just
wake
so,
them up. You got to really just, shake them up.
It's just so infuriating. All right. So sticking on the topic of things that are infuriating, the IRS whistleblower. The first guy that came forward and wrote a letter to members of Congress saying there's a lot of irregularities with this years-long IRS investigation into Hunter Biden, which is a pathway to the larger Biden Inc. investigation. His identity was confirmed. We mentioned yesterday that John Solomon's news outlet Just the News confirmed the IRS whistleblower's name is Gary Shapley. He is apparently going to be testifying before House committee later today. He gave his first public interview to CBS News yesterday, and here's what he said about the investigation.
It was my red line meeting. It just got to that point where that switch was turned on, and I just couldn't silence my conscience anymore.
Did you let prosecutors know you were unhappy?
I don't think I can answer that.
That was when the switch was flipped. He brought apparently these irregularities that he was witnessing to prosecutors and said there's something going on here, and they were dismissive.
There was multiple steps that were slow walked at the direction of the Department of Justice.
Had you ever encountered that before?
I have not, no. These deviations from normal process, and each and every time it seemed to always benefit the subject.
Mm. Right. Deviations that always benefit one side. Right. Duh. All these happy coincidences that always benefit one side.
This is
right.
This happens over and over again, man. You know, it makes you wonder. It makes me breathe a sigh of relief that Merrick Garland,
yeah.
Merrick Garland was not confirmed to the Supreme Court. This guy has absolutely no principles whatsoever in terms of being the Attorney General of the United States, in terms of some of the things he's done relative to these investigations and how he stood in the way of justice more so than promoting it. Can you imagine if he was on the Supreme Court for life? Oh my
God. No, you know, Mitch McConnell deserves credit for that one. Yeah. Shapley also explained his motivation. Now, of course, it's going to be treated as, oh, he's just some sort of you know, partisan operative within the IRS because he's a Republican. But Shapley had this to say on that.
I don't want to do any of this. I took an oath of office, and when I saw the egregiousness of some of these things, it no longer became a choice for me. It's not something that I want to do. It's something that I feel like I have to do.
Mm-hmm. And now we have another whistleblower who has been unnamed, a subordinate. I think he's at a step or two lower than Shapley within IRS, who is also blowing the whistle in the same direction that Shapley is. What will come of it? I without even taking callers, I'm feeling the skepticism. But again, at least you have individuals coming forward and providing details that can be investigated, providing a roadmap so that members of Congress know where to ask the questions, what documents to seek, who else to whistle before the relevant committees. So it's not without purpose that Shapley is coming forward. And I have to go back just on this whole IRS thing, too. That Chuck Todd conversation with it was Byron Donalds this last weekend, mm-hmm. that past Sunday, where he said, you know, the IRS, so Republicans making a big deal about these 80,000 new agents to the IRS, and this is part of the debt ceiling and Broglio not providing the funding for 80,000 more IRS agents. It's like, well, what is that? I never understood why Republicans are for fewer agents at the IRS. Don't you want the IRS to collect all the taxes that are due the federal government? That's the attitude of
that's
the left.
That's Chuck Todd.
Yeah, that's the attitude of the left. It's instructive.
Well, you know, it's an elitist position, certainly. I mean, he certainly isn't connected to the vast majority of American taxpayers. I mean, who wants to pay more taxes?
Right. And you know, that's all the IRS does. These are just green eye shades, guys, making sure the government gets its due, making sure you render onto Caesar what is Caesar's. Really? And then you have the story, which Chuck Todd, I'm sure, has blocked out of his consciousness, of Matt Taibbi, who may have been the journalist, right, mm-hmm. who is doing, has been doing the stories on the Russian collusion hoax and bicked, and he's one of the Twitter Files journalists. And he testified before that House Weaponization of Government Committee that he got visited by the IRS out of left field. Actually, it was the House Judiciary Committee. That IRS agent made a surprise visit to his Jersey residence on March 9th, the same day he testified before another House committee about censorship at Twitter.
Right.
The journalist was told there were identity theft concerns with his 2021 and 2018 tax returns. The Taibbi said the 2018 claim was particularly troubling because his accountants possessed documentation showing the return had been electronically accepted, and neither they nor he ever received notification of a problem. But 5 years later, the IRS shows up at his house after he testifies before a House committee on big tech collusion with the deep state, and he's got a knock on the door. Hey, we may have an identity theft problem with your 2018 return. Yeah, no, that's not suspicious at all.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, we're reviewing your 2018 return, and probably other returns. Which is basically saying, hey, you're being watched.
Well, the other thing here, I mean, just going on the Taibbi case as illustrative of the problem at IRS, politicized agency, just like FBI, just like DOJ, just like CIA, documents that have been obtained by Taibbi, that show that in addition to the unannounced house call in March, an IRS agent dived deep into Taibbi's personal life, compiling a file of his voter registration records, whether he had a concealed carry permit, whether he possessed hunting or fishing licenses, The file contained his wiki page detailing his Twitter files work. And then the IRS launched this look into Taibbi's background, even though he didn't owe the IRS any money. So it's just about rendering unto Caesar what Caesar's, right? We're supposed to believe that.
Yeah, we're supposed to believe that. But how do you now that this dragon is out of the box, how do you put it back in? Man, it's frightening.
Well, this is, why that little election we have coming up a year from November is going to be so mission critical, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, with all the ballot harvesting that goes on and the way that they set things up and the fact that they can use many of these same agencies to further that end, it's frightening. I mean, it is really, really frightening at this point.
What Gary Shapley is saying, and by the way, you know, how many years has the Hunter Biden investigation been going on?
Yeah.
And in the last few months, how much information has Jim Comer and the House Oversight Committee been able to pull together that provides a roadmap for the IRS or DOJ, for that matter, to investigate and come to some conclusion in a timely manner, like, you know, our respective lifetimes, including Hunter Biden's and the rest of the Biden family, for that matter? I mean, give me a break. It's obvious that there is an effort to slow walk it, if not spike it altogether. And by the way, we know that same thing happened with Hunter Biden's laptop over at FBI and T-Bolt, the agent there that quietly retired when he was outed as having had attempted to spike the Hunter Biden investigation. And so you'll pardon House Republicans if they say, well, you know, the $80 billion cash infusion the IRS got last year to hire 87,000 more agents. Yeah, we're not real good with that. Pete in Elburn, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, you know, what Chuck Todd said kind of got me going, because it's one of those phrases we end up saying sometimes, and we got to catch ourselves because it's a trap when we end up saying, well, what are you worried about if you're not doing anything wrong?
Yeah,
those are the things through history that's fascism. That's what every fascist regime does, is say, what are you worried about if you're not doing anything wrong in our eyes? And it's a total trap. We need to catch ourselves. Chuck Todd should quit his job, because that's a nonsense phrase that's been used over and over.
Thanks for the call, Pete. Dan and Charles Thomason for Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning is former ABC7 political reporter Charles Thomas.
Good morning.
And Charles, we've got full theatrics now attendant to the debt ceiling raise debate. Our very own Calamity Jan Schakowsky.
Calamity Jan?
Calamity like Jan Schakowsky. She and some of her mates had a little press avail yesterday where she introduced us to Janet, quote unquote.
Janet?
Her name is Janet, and she called my office in tears. She was so afraid. She is 64 years old. Her income is $1,200 a month. She has chronic mental illness. She cannot work. She would like to work, but she cannot. And she is so afraid that if they do what they're going to do, that she cannot pay the rent. She cannot pay for any food. She can't pay for the medication that she needs. These tough guys who don't want to negotiate. Mm-hmm. This is the hostage that they want to take. And there are millions of Janets all over the world.
Had I been at the presser, my question would have been, Representative Schakowsky, is that 64-year-old with chronic mental illness named Janet, is that really you? I love this tack.
Just cold-blooded, man.
I love this tack that they're taking. AOC said the same thing. Kevin McCarthy won't negotiate with us. Why does he have to negotiate with you? They passed a debt ceiling raise bill. They're the only chamber to do it. And McCarthy has been pleading with the president to negotiate with him. And they've had several meetings. So why does he have to come back and negotiate with AOC and Jan Schakowsky? And that's a hostage situation. They voted their shares and they passed the package. They passed. Your buddy Schumer in the Senate could do the same thing. And then they'd go talk to the big guy and see if they can strike a deal. I don't understand how this is so complicated for them. But it is. The wonderful theatrics, though.
Yeah, it's theatrics. I got to think it's theatrics. And the president is in a, basically, he's in a lose-lose situation because the power of the purse strings, of course, is in the House. And he has to deal with them at some point. Well, he just has to.
Well, the other thing about this, I'll be serious for a minute. The woman that she's talking about, I'll take it at face value. The woman she's talking about that has mental health issues and she only makes 12 grand a year and so forth. The government doesn't cease to exist if you pass the debt ceiling deadline. They're still taking in billions of dollars in revenue. So you would be compelled to only spend what you take in for as long as it takes to strike a deal, you know, a more global deal, such as the one that the House Republicans passed. The idea that everything just goes to zero at midnight is a lie.
But, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm no expert on government finance. But if there are spending cuts associated with this, then that will mean that Joe Biden and the other Democrats will not be able to go to as many ribbon cuttings next year as they would like to go to.
Well,
because they don't have the money. Is that part of this?
Yeah, that's about the sum total of it, frankly. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Brett Baer. Of course, he's the host of Fox News' Special Report, 5 p.m. Chicago time during the week. Number one bestselling author of To Rescue the Republic, Ulysses S. Grant, The Fragile Union and the Crisis of 1876. Brett, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
So on the debt ceiling melodrama, do you sense or know from the conversations you have that there is give from the White House coming on the spending side and also, importantly, the work requirements for welfare piece?
They're hung up, the last part. But they're very close, and I think they're going to get a handshake deal either today or tomorrow.
Oh, wow, okay.
They have to in order to be able to logistically do it. There are now new rules where a bill has to be on the floor or in consideration for 72 hours, and the Senate has its own stipulations as well. You know, just back to your previous conversation, you're right. The president didn't negotiate for 97 days, and, you know, the House did what it did. It passed this bill. The Senate has not. And why? Because he cannot. He doesn't have the votes to pass a bill on their own. And so you're right, the drama is quite something to look at. Number one, because the House did its job, and number two, because what they're talking about is taking spending back not to the 1950s to last year. Last year numbers. And Washington, when you are cutting spending, you're not really cutting spending. You're cutting the increases to spending. They call that cutting spending, but it's really just cutting the increases over time. So they're trying to roll it back 1 year. They're trying to get some work requirements and ideally permitting for energy projects. But it may be a long shot in this negotiation.
See, but Brett, we can't go back to the bad old days of 2022 when Biden was in the White House and Democrats had control of the Senate. We just can't do that.
Yeah. So that's what's lost in all of these hysterics is that, you know, these are Democrat numbers, actually, from last year. So, you know, it's not like it's going back to the dark ages or to your point that it stops and goes to zero and the government fails to operate. It's not like that. And I think that the White House is going to succumb to some of this, and they're going to have to eat it on their progressive side. I think
that's
what's going to happen because the Republicans did what they had to do, which was get the votes to pass the bill.
And so, not to mention, despite the protestations about the polling, the polling across the political spectrum shows that the Republican position of spending reduction or slowing the growth of spending, as you more properly said, in order to raise the debt ceiling is something that is supported by a majority, almost a majority of Democrats.
Yeah, and because people understand that we as a country do some really stupid things with money. And at $32 trillion in debt, eventually that comes home. Everybody deals with things at their kitchen table. They know they can't be spending astronomically and never have a payoff. And that's what's happening in the government.
With respect to the work requirements, so, I mean, how do you split the difference there? I mean, there either is going to be a work requirement for single able-bodied people or there isn't.
I don't know what the language looks like. I think they're trying to stiffen, some of the language so that they're, I don't know if it's going to be encouraging work requirement. There's not going to be a requirement then. It's that's where they're hung up. Republicans really want it. Democrats are pretty firm on that. I think that that's what has taken so long. But as far as the numbers and the capping and all of that, they pretty much reached a consensus on that.
All right. I want to get to the presidential contest on the Republican side with the entrance of both Senator Tim Scott and Governor Ron DeSantis this week. And Donald Trump welcomed Tim Scott into the race. Of course he did. I'll let you comment on that in a second. But here is one of the ways that Donald Trump welcomed Ron DeSantis into the race. Take a listen.
2016, President Trump defeats the liberals and heads to Washington to drain the swamp. But swamp creature Ron DeSantis is about to start his third term in Congress, and he's already voted repeatedly to cut Social Security and Medicare. 2017, Trump passes huge tax cuts for nearly everyone. And Ron DeSantis? He's pushing a bill that would swap those tax cuts for a new 23% national sales tax, making families pay more. 2018, Trump is building the wall, securing the border, fighting the invasion, while Ron DeSantis is voting against funding for Trump's wall. In Washington, one was a leader and one let us down. Even DeSantis admitted there are big differences between him and Trump.
Obviously there is because I've not voted contrary to him in the Congress.
It is obvious, Ron. President Trump is the only one ready on day one to deliver for us again. Make America.
Setting aside some of the questionable accusations in the ad, actually very misleading. But the question is Ron DeSantis willing to go toe-to-toe with Donald Trump? Because Donald Trump is willing to go right between the eyes of Ron DeSantis.
I think you're going to start to see that. I think he was waiting until getting in the race. I think Team DeSantis' Twitter page put up a compilation of Donald Trump as president saying, I have to shut the country down exponentially, saying it over 2 minutes' time, a million different ways. I'm shutting the country down. It was the right thing to do.
Right.
We got to lock people up, all this stuff. So when, Trump says that for some reason he says the Florida governor was the shutdown governor during COVID, it's exactly the opposite. And so you have to kind of fact check those claims. It's just worth pointing out that the Trump PAC, Make America Great Again, LLC, has spent more money on Ron DeSantis's head than it spent in all of 2022 supporting Republican candidates around the country already. And so that is obviously where they see the biggest threat, and they're putting the most money.
And with respect to Tim Scott, he's got Larry Ellison behind him. He's got significant funds. He is a likable guy. Conservatives who know him like him. And what exactly he'll do. He seems like less of a guy who's going to get into a barroom brawl than maybe Ron DeSantis. But that could open a third lane if those two are engaged in an extended food fight. And I just wonder how DeSantis' world has to navigate that, because if you have a viable third candidate in this contest for the nomination, that really makes it difficult for DeSantis, given where Trump starts.
Definitely. You're right. And this is how Trump won in 2015, 2016, is that Marco Rubio spent $30 million on Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush spent $40 million on Marco Rubio. Everybody was going after each other, and then Donald Trump hit the gap and never turned back. And, you know, if Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump go after each other and spend a lot of money on each other, there potentially is another lane for nice guy, humble, get it done, bring the country together. I mean, it is possible. And I think that's where Tim Scott, you know, their headspace is. I think that Nikki Haley is trying to get that too. So there will be one alternative to the former president, and that's what they're battling for now. You know, our first debate is in August, and we'll see who's on that stage.
Yeah, right around the corner. And also, too, I mean, you know, who knows, catch fire the way that Trump did. I mean, Vivek Ramaswamy is another one that has to be in the conversation because he is super sharp. He is speaking with moral clarity on a range of issues. He is taking positions that are provocative on issues like raising the voting age to 25 that get people talking. Whether you agree or disagree, he's getting people talking. He's getting notoriety. And so, you know, somebody like him representing a major generational shift in political leadership, too, who knows what kind of impact he could have, a la like a Mayor Pete.
Yeah. Now, those people have to make some headway quickly. You know, they've got to first qualify for a debate stage. And secondly, they need to make a lot of headway quickly, because by the time you get to actual voting in the new year, you know, they'll have to be in position. He has moved from like 1% to 4%. Ramaswamy has. I think that the people like Asa Hutchinson and others, the North Dakota governor is getting in the race June 7th. People, you know, it's just, I don't know. There's like a free-for-all getting in the race. Chris Christie's going to get in the race, apparently. And so the more people are in there for the longer period of time, the better position the former president is to take the plurality of the vote.
Well, and the other thing right now, and I know this could change, it's a snapshot in time, but right now Trump is also undermining the main argument that DeSantis has been making, which is that I can be Joe Biden and Donald Trump can't, the electability argument. We need to start winning again. But the polling, the Harvard-Harris poll, for example, both nationally and in swing states like in the Rust Belt, has Trump outperforming Ron DeSantis against Joe Biden at present.
That's right. And so that argument is tougher to make if it's actually the Real Clear Politics recent poll has both DeSantis and Trump beating Biden by a couple of points. So it's about the same. You're right. That is a big deal. Electability, that's going to be a big conversation for Republicans. I think the president is pretty weak now. If you look at the economic numbers, you look at approval across the board. Independents are down to 29 in some of these polls. That's untenable for reelection unless they run against the former president as extremist and they fire up people who just don't want Donald Trump to be president again.
This just represents my, you know, idle musings. But do you believe there's any possibility, maybe even something afoot, that Joe Biden ducks out in the 11th hour and a deal is cut to not give anybody any time to do anything other than Gavin Newsom?
It's very possible, but if that happens, what are we saying about Kamala Harris? I mean, is the Democratic Party just going to turn their back on their first woman of color vice president? I'm not sure, and that's a tough issue for the party. But I agree with you; that is talked about in Washington. That you know, they say at the 11th hour, you know what? No, he's not going to do it.
He is Brett Baer, the host of Fox News Special Report, 5 p.m. weekdays, number one bestselling author of To Rescue the Republic, Ulysses S. Grant, The Fragile Union, and The Crisis of 1876. Brett, thank you as always. Appreciate it.
Have a good one.
You too. And you joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Now, from the Signature Bank Studios, this is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and former ABC 7 political reporter Charles Thomas in for Amy J. this morning. And Charles, interesting piece over at the Free Press, that's Barry Weiss's outlet. The debate in high schools is over. Actually, the debates, plural, are over. This piece by a former high school debate champion who also debated at the collegiate level, did fairly well. And he coached a debate team at an underprivileged high school a few years back, underprivileged high school in Miami. And he describes what he calls witnessing the pillars of high school debate start to crumble. Not surprising, if it happens on a college campus, then it's going to go back to secondary and primary schools. It's going to radiate out into the culture, and that's what's happened.
Mm-hmm.
We all live on a college campus now, as Andrew Sullivan famously said a few years ago. And he is referencing the judges in these debate competitions and their paradigms. There's a public database maintained by the Debating Society that where judges post quote-unquote paradigms, which explain what they look for during a debate. Because, of course, those participating in the debate won't know until just before the debate who will be judging them. For example, if a judge prefers competitors not to speak a mile a minute, debaters might moderate their pace. If a judge emphasizes impacts, the reason why an argument matters, debaters adjust accordingly. But he goes on to say, let's say when the high school sophomore clicks the on this inventory of all the judges and their paradigms, she sees that her judge is Lila Lavender, the 2019 national debate champion, whose paradigm reads, quote, "Before anything else, including being a debate judge, I am a Marxist-Leninist Maoist. I cannot check the revolutionary proletarian science at the door when I'm judging. I will no longer evaluate and thus never vote for rightist, capitalist, imperialist positions and arguments. Examples of arguments of this nature are as follows. Fascism good, capitalism good, imperialist war good, neoliberalism good, defensive U.S. or otherwise bourgeois nationalism, Zionism, or normalizing Israel, colonialism good, U.S. white fascist policing good, etc." So the author makes the point, how does a high school sophomore feel when she walks into a room who maybe is not a Marxist-Leninist Maoist, and she walks into a room to make an argument about some public policy matter, and she's facing Lila Lavender.
And this person remains a debate judge.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a lot like what's going on in journalism, believe it or not.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's like there's certain criteria now that you have to.
Contrast that with another paradigm he shares. A former West Point debater named Henry Smith, his paradigm asks students to, quote, "focus on clarity over speed," and reminds them that every argument should explain exactly how and how they win the debate. Okay, that's neutral. But then we go back to another one, like Shubham Gupta. Quote, "if you are discussing immigrants in a round and describe the person as illegal, I will immediately stop the round, give you the loss with low speaker points, give you a stern lecture, and then talk to your coach. I will not have you making the debate space unsafe."
And illegal is one of the naughty words. You can't say illegal when discussing anyone who might enter the country.
Right.
By means other than those prescribed by law.
Yes, right. Maybe that's the way you'd have to say it. People who enter the country by means other than those prescribed by law.
Incredible.
That's the way. I don't know. You'd probably still get that stern lecture. For more on what's happening in K-12 education generally, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Ian Rowe, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, visiting fellow at the Woodson Center, author of Agency, the 4-Point Plan for All Children to Overcome the Victimhood Narrative and Discover Their Pathway to Power. I think the title of that book would trigger some of these judges, and I think Ian Rowe would get a stern lecture, too, as well. Ian, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
I very much, but I'd respond. I wouldn't concede my voice.
Well, I mean, but, you know, it's just an interesting piece about a relatively you know, small part of the high school and collegiate experience, but it does speak to the larger culture around expressing yourself. And I mean, just how the illiberal have insinuated themselves in every space in the country, particularly in places of ostensibly learning.
No, no, absolutely. My colleague, Sam Abrams at AEI, did a study last year where he found something like 60 to 70% of high school students self-censor, that they're fearful of expressing an opinion that they think would differ from what they believe their teacher thinks or what their peers think. So better just not to share their opinion at all. And that kind of, and so you wonder why when kids get to college or higher education, they're so intolerant of other views, or they just allow things to happen without, putting forth competing ideas. It's very dangerous for our country. And, you know, part of the reason, you know, I'm on this morning is that, you know, there's now another example of it with the New York Times. I mean, you know, you're talking about debate. The New York Times, some of your viewers might know, had a magazine issue a couple of years ago called the 1619 Project, oh, yeah, where they argue that the United States is, you know, the founding principles are false when they were written. The country wasn't even founded in 1776, but it was founded in 1619. They've just created a new curriculum unit for high school focused on reparations math. It's not about math. It's about convincing
math.
Young people. Yeah. It's about convincing young people that black people in this country, or black young people, are not free. They're still enslaved and are owed by the federal government trillions of dollars of money. And in this curriculum, there's no competing point of view. You know, you're just supposed to take these lessons and then just believe that black people are inherent victims. It's outrageous.
And the math, the reparations math, what's the math piece of this? The just sort of talking generally about numbers like we see in these commissions that have been stood up by Gavin Newsom,
yes,
or
exactly,
or Brandon,
exactly,
Johnson.
I mean, let's not mention the fact that based on the most recent National Assessment for Educational Progress, something like only 8 or 9% of black students are doing math at proficiency levels. I mean, just think about that for a second. More than 90% of black students in this country are not doing math at proficiency levels. And what the New York Times 1619 Project is putting forth is a math curriculum that is much less about math than it is about the ideology that they're trying to implement. So the kinds of assignments are, well, if a white person X number of years ago had this number of slaves and, a slave was worth this much, and, you know, what's the formula that you would use to calculate how much you're owed as a black person today? I mean, extremely rudimentary, very basic math, which is not even at the high school level, because you realize it's actually not about teaching math. It's about teaching the ideology. And that's what's so dangerous. I mean, look, if someone wanted to focus on the topic of reparations as a subject matter, it's certainly worthy of exploration. It's a phenomena that has occurred. But what this is actually trying to use math as the vehicle through which you're pulling into this idea that you're forever victimized, both historic and present day, and it just has to be called out for what it is: indoctrination into an ideology that's destructive and divisive.
And when we're talking about this being part of the 1619 Project curriculum that is pushed into public schools, we're talking about a curriculum that's in thousands of schools after a few years now, right?
Unfortunately, when the New York Times decided they wanted to go just beyond a magazine issue, you know, where they're engaging mostly adult readers, they said, you know what, we want the hearts and minds of young people. So they crafted a curriculum. You know, in response, Bob Woodson, you know, great leader at the Woodson Center, said, you know what, we're going to create a curriculum in response to this that tells a more expansive story of the African-American experience in the United States. And we built this amazing curriculum, warts and all, that tells not only, for example, the story of the Tulsa Massacre, but it tells the story of the creation of black wealth and the creation of Black Wall Street, you know, during Jim Crow. How was it that during this period of time, you know, black people could amass such wealth? Then we tell the story of the Tulsa Massacre, and then we tell the story of the rebuild. So basically, tell the whole story, warts and all. This curriculum has now been downloaded more than 85,000 times by teachers in all 50 states, in every kind of school, private school, public school, religious school, charter school, homeschool. And so it was important to provide this counterbalance to what we thought was this very negative cherry-picking curriculum that the New York Times is now imposing into schools. And by the way, and not just any schools, in some of the lowest performing schools in the country, Chicago, Newark. I mean, these are schools where the literacy rates are typically in the single digits. And so to have a curriculum which is now foisting this ideology that, you know, it's the country that's racist and harmful, and that's why you're not doing well, as opposed to the kinds of strategies that we know are so important for uplifting all kids. So yes, the New York Times put together this curriculum. The reparations math is now their next evolution. And again, it's just harmful for children.
You know, I would agree that, you know, this is a matter of what is the narrative that you, under which you teach history. The facts remain the same, but the narrative, black people are overcomers. We are not victims.
Right.
We are victors. And our history is proof positive of that, that we have met every challenge and overcome. And I think that's what we need to teach, as opposed to the narrative that we are victims and will remain victims forever.
You know, what you just said is so profound. I mean, listen to this. So the New York Times partnered with the Pulitzer Center, and they published the curriculum. And something that curriculum providers do typically to demonstrate the strength of their curriculum is they have examples of student work. Right, because once you show examples of student work who've completed that curriculum, then you really get to see the quality of learning. So listen to this example. This is literally the first example that the Pulitzer Center publishes as proof of the effectiveness of their reparations math curriculum. This is what a black student wrote in high school who completed the curriculum. Quote, "What I learned after this curriculum is that we as black people are still not free," end quote. This is what the Pulitzer Center, mission accomplished. This is the proof of the effectiveness of the curriculum.
In Illinois, you may have heard, you may not, because it's fresh. We just became the first state in the nation to rescind a tax credit scholarship program, an opportunity scholarship program that had been implemented. So Illinois continues to lead the nation in being the bad example. But given what you're saying, I mean, first of all, for those who don't know, Ian ran charter schools in the Bronx. What you know about education and what you know about the school choice movement and what you're describing in terms of the Woodson curriculum being downloaded by teachers, but then you've got the Pulitzer Foundation, the New York Times, and the 1619 Project funded by corporate America, all driving this curriculum through most of the government schools. How important is the school choice movement, which, by the way, is still very healthy in more than two dozen states, but how important is that school choice movement to sustain it so that parents do have a choice to not send their kids to schools where nobody learns to read or do math, literally in some cases.
Right.
You know, just comment on the yeah. how important school choice is as part of this effort to push back against against reparations math.
Well, you know, I always love the people who are from middle and upper class communities who are, you know, who you can't have school choice. That's going to wreck the public school system. And of course, they exercise school choice every single day for their children. You know, they're moving to the suburbs. They're sending their kids to private schools. So the thought of them not having school choice for their own children, oh, it's so deeply hypocritical. And so the most vulnerable students in our country, the ones who are in most desperate need of high quality education, those are the young people who are generally being deprived of school choice. In the district in which we just launched a virtues-based international baccalaureate high school in the Bronx in District 12. District 7. Only 7% of the kids that start ninth grade 4 years later graduate from high school ready for college, meaning that 93% start ninth grade and either drop out or they actually do earn their high school diploma but still can't do math nor reading without remediation. And this is a district in, you know, throughout New York City where there's a cap on charter schools, meaning that if someone had a great idea, you couldn't do it. And so imagine you're a parent, you're a 22-year-old parent, whatever decisions you may have made in your own life, you want the best for your kid. But the only choice that you have is to send them to a school where historically only 93% of kids aren't graduating from high school ready for college. That's the reality. You know, and so for folks who are, you know, exercising choice in their own lives, but depriving it of kids who are in desperate need, it's the ultimate hypocrisy. So we have to fight for educational freedom, school choice. It's fundamental. There are other elements that matter as well, strong families, you know, access to strong faith commitment. So there are other elements that are important. But if we're depriving kids of the very first rung, which is access to a high quality education, why is it that we think we'll get better outcomes down the road for these kids who aren't being given a real shot?
He is Ian Rowe, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, visiting fellow at the Woodson Center, author of the book Agency, The Four-Point Plan for All Children to Overcome the Victimhood Narrative and Discover Their Pathway to Power. You should pick that book up, and you should download the 1776 curriculum from the Woodson Center that Ian Rowe was talking about as well.
And it's free of charge, by the way. That curriculum is free of charge.
Very good.
It's amazing.
You know, we're talking about whether or not kids should go to college anymore. Pretty soon we're going to be talking about whether kids should go to high school or grade school anymore. Just, you know, Khan Academy, the Woodson curriculum, you can piece together an education that's better, right?
Well, there's been an explosion in homeschooling since COVID. More and more parents, particularly in the Black community, went from 3.3% to 16.1% of Black parents interested in homeschooling for their kids. You know, it's happening. It's not happening enough, but it is happening.
Ian Rowe, thanks so much for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And he joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning is former ABC 7 political reporter Charles Thomas. Earlier this week, Congressman Andy Biggs of Arizona queried January 6th lead prosecutor Matthew Graves about one case in particular that you heard it at the top of the hour in the news, one of the so-called Oath Keepers who was convicted of crimes related to his conduct on January 6th. Thomas Caldwell is his name. here was that exchange between Biggs and January 6th lead prosecutor Matthew Graves.
I want to ask about a specific January 6th defendant, a guy named Thomas Caldwell, decorated disabled Navy veteran, no criminal history, 70 years old, not charged with any violent crime on January 6th. In fact, he never entered the Capitol building, but you added a seditious conspiracy charge to his case after you took office, enhancing the charges that had already been filed against him. He was convicted ultimately of one obstruction count and one with tampering with evidence. He's 70 years old. You're seeking 14 years in prison. I guess my question is, doesn't that seem like a death sentence to Mr. Caldwell, who did not commit a crime of violence that day?
So I understand the desire to know more about the case. That's obviously an active, ongoing investigation, and my ethical rules and department guidance preclude.
He was convicted. You're getting ready for sentencing. You can answer the question with regard to why you want him to go to sentencing. It's not investigation. It's not ongoing. He's been convicted of two crimes. I need to know.
So
why?
I understand your desire to know. As you said in the predicate to your question, he is pending sentencing. It would be wholly inappropriate for me in a public forum to weigh in on why I think that's an appropriate sentence.
Mm-hmm. My time's expired. Thanks.
Yeah, we'll wait for the public forum called a court of law. That's also a public forum. But okay. What about those Oath Keeper sentences, including the top line one for the founder of the Oath Keepers, a Yale law grad and former military named Stuart Rhodes, who got 18 years. Julie Kelly joins us now, senior contributor for American Greatness and author of January 6th, How Democrats Use the Capitol Protest to Launch a War on Terror Against the Political Right. Julie, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Charles. Thanks for having me on.
Good morning.
Tell us the story of Thomas Caldwell and what sentence was meted out on him.
So Thomas Caldwell and his wife were awakened at about 5:30 in the morning in their Virginia home in January of 2021, about 2 weeks after January 6th, to an armed FBI raid with SWAT vehicles surrounding their home. As you said, Mr. Caldwell is a, and I've spoken with them, interviewed them, a disabled, decorated Navy veteran, former lieutenant in the Navy. He was arrested. He was denied bail. His wife, Sharon, FBI agents had firearms aimed at her. She was covered in red dots in her nightgown. Called him off. He spent about 60 days in pretrial detention before he was finally released. He was not a member of the Oath Keepers. He was the so-called associate. So this is one of the alleged militia groups who brought no firearms to the Capitol on January 6th, had no weapons, but nonetheless were accused of basically being domestic terrorists. So he has been tormented by this DOJ, as over 1,000 people have been. And so he was subjected to an FBI raid, and they charged him with obstruction of an official proceeding, this post-Enron felony, conspiracy, and a few other low-level misdemeanors.
What did he do on that day? What did he do on January 6th? It was mentioned by Representative Biggs he didn't enter the Capitol. So what did he do?
He and his wife, Sharon, went to Trump's speech. They walked towards the Capitol. As I said, he was 67 at the time, disabled, has severe back injuries, walked as far as they could, stood outside of the Capitol grounds, did not go inside, but nonetheless, because the Oath Keepers group was already being surveilled by the government, they had informants run into the Oath Keepers months before January 6th. So they knew all of their movements. He did nothing wrong. He didn't carry a weapon. He didn't assault anyone. He didn't vandalize anything. He didn't even go inside the building. Because he was connected to this group that the FBI and DOJ and Biden regime wants to believe is a domestic terror organization, this is why his life has been basically ruined. Then after he was originally charged, Matthew Graves, who you just heard, the D.C. U.S. attorney, he was appointed by Biden and then started handing down these ridiculous seditious conspiracy charges. So he added that felony count to Mr. Caldwell and almost two dozen other members of the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys. This is tantamount to treason. It's a Civil War era statute. For example, some of the people who've been convicted of a seditious conspiracy are the Blind Sheik and nine of his associates who bombed the World Trade Center in 1993, killed six people, and injured 1,000. That's what that statute's for, not for people who went inside a government building, walked around, left, or certainly not people like Stuart Rhodes and Thomas Caldwell, who never even went inside.
And what was Caldwell's sentence? What was Caldwell's sentence?
The government, Matthew Graves right there, is asking for 14 years in prison. All of these men have been, Graves is also asking for a terror enhancement for their sentencing. And so yesterday, Stuart Rhodes, the founder and leader of the Oath Keepers, was sentenced to 18 years in prison by Judge Amit Mehta, an Obama appointee. And Kelly Meggs, a Florida Oath Keeper, was sentenced to 12 years in prison.
And so we're still waiting to hear on Caldwell what his sentence will be.
Yes, his sentence has been delayed. The judge is considering a motion from his defense attorney. I think Mehta got a little bit shaken up after that public exchange between Congressman Biggs and Matthew Graves. So he's delayed that sentencing. But there's two more sentences today for two more Oath Keepers.
Now, look, I'm not a fan of the Oath Keepers group. I understand Stuart Rhodes's sort of position. It's not a new one that there is nothing legitimate about following illegitimate government orders. So, I mean, it's essentially my understanding is they sort of take the position that they swear an oath to the Constitution and the rights and responsibilities contained therein. And any law they feel that is violative of the Constitution, they're at their discretion to ignore. So I don't subscribe to that. I can't subscribe to that. That's not the basis for a free society. However, that doesn't mean that they're a terrorist organization. It doesn't mean they're violent. It means they have a particular viewpoint. Have there been and I understand that many of the members or associates of the Oath Keepers are former military and law enforcement. But have there been incidents where the Oath Keepers have preemptively engaged in violence that you're aware of, including on January 6th?
Absolutely not. They went there similar to the Proud Boys, although the Proud Boys are a little more aggressive and younger. But to your point, the Oath Keepers are mostly former military law enforcement, and they're alarmed at what's happening in the country, as a lot of us are and should be. So they went to the Capitol to help provide security, because what had been happening in D.C. throughout 2020, especially at Stop the Steal rallies in November and December of 2020, when Trump supporters, young children, mothers were being assaulted and attacked by Antifa and BLM rioters. So they went there to protect people who were going to be protesting and help the police. There's a video people can see on my Twitter feed, Julie_Kelly2, of Kelly Meggs in military gear inside the Capitol helping police, talking to police. Police are standing right next to him. He is directing people out of the Capitol building. He's not in there trying to find Nancy Pelosi or overthrow Congress. Nothing of the sort. They viewed themselves as a backup to police who they feared would be overrun by Antifa and left-wing rioters, as they had tried to tear down the city for 6 months in 2020.
And Stuart Rhodes, the founder of Oath Keepers, he got 18 years because he was convicted of seditious conspiracy, correct?
Correct. He and Kelly Meggs were both are the two Oath Keepers convicted of seditious conspiracy. There are four more in a separate trial who also were convicted of seditious conspiracy. They walked inside the building. They were there for about 5 or 6 minutes and walked out.
And so, since you follow this more closely than just about anybody in the country, what was the thrust of the evidence presented by the state that persuaded a jury that these were seditious conspirators?
Mostly text messages in group chats and video messages made by Stuart Rhodes. It's important, too, for people to understand, these jury trials are happening in Washington, D.C., a nearly 100% Democratic city. It also, the jury selection proceedings were happening at the same time the January 6th Select Committee were holding televised hearings a few blocks away from the courthouse where these people were on trial fighting for their lives. The judges don't care. They don't care about the conflicts. They don't care about the due process rights or any rights of these defendants. This is all a political show.
And the text messages and the videos that were entered into evidence, did they indicate, did Stuart Rhodes say that we're going on January 6th to overthrow the federal government? We're going to stop Congress from putting its stamp of approval on Biden's election. We're going to stop this by any means necessary. We have a plan to wrestle control of the federal government away from the political class. I mean, what did the text messages and videos say that were incriminating?
It was to organize people to travel there, and it was to protest. And some of the language, just like in the Proud Boys, some of the language is probably not anything you and I would be discussing. A lot of it was pretty inflammatory, but that it was in group chats. It was certainly nothing that was even close to being executed.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a very strong distinction between First A, 1A Amendment rights and protected speech, especially in group chats. You're not publicly saying this. You're not out there trying to round up. There were like 30 of them who went. They didn't bring thousands of people to the Capitol to overthrow Congress. They were very upset about the election, as a lot of Americans were. And they wanted to do something. They wanted to protest. There were a lot of things happening in Washington that day. They wanted to be part of it. But they also were fearful about what had happened at other rallies where some of them had been in 2020, wanted to protect themselves and wanted to protect others. So you could disagree with the language that they use. That does not make them seditionists. It does not mean that they were trying to overthrow Congress.
Were there specific threats of violence in those messages?
I'm trying to think. There were tons of thousands of messages.
Yes.
So they did bring firearms to their hotel in Virginia, but they left them there because they didn't want to violate D.C.'s gun control laws. But they thought that serious violence was going to take place in Washington, D.C. that day. Not because of what they were going to do, what had already been happening in D.C. the last half of 2020.
And where does this stand? How many people are still in prison awaiting trial? And what of the reports that we heard a few weeks back that the FBI was still eyeing rounding up several hundred more Americans associated with Jan 6th?
So there's more than 1,000 defendants already. Matthew Graves, the man who you heard in the clip, told the Washington Post last year that he's going to double that caseload figure. They are planning to arrest and charge another 1,000 Americans who protested on January 6th. It's very important for people to understand what this means. This is all to create a legal case against Donald Trump. This is not just rounding up January 6thers or Trump supporters. This is all to help build a very similar criminal case against Donald Trump. I feel very strongly now with the Proud Boys seditious conspiracy convictions last month, and now these convictions and harsh sentences. This will help bolster Special Counsel Jack Smith, who has been investigating January 6th since November, since Merrick Garland appointed him, that he will go. He is already working with the grand jury that he's going to seek this similar count and many others against Donald Trump. Because these two groups are tied to him.
Tied to him in what way? Tied to him because the federal government says they're tied to him? Tied to him because they were Trump supporters, or tied to him in some material way?
The first two, because the government says so and because they were Trump supporters.
Right.
The Oath Keepers, for example, were giving security to Roger Stone on the 5th and 6th. So that will be the tie into the Oath Keepers and Donald Trump.
She is Julie Kelly, senior contributor for American Greatness, amgreatness.com, author of the book January 6th, How Democrats Used the Capitol Protest to Launch a War on Terror Against the Political Right. January 6th, the name of Julie Kelly's book. Julie, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Have a great weekend.
You too. She joined us on the turnkey.pro Angela line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Open mic! Open mic Friday! Call in now! Open mic Friday!
Dan and in for Amy this morning has been Charles Thomas, ABC7 political reporter. And yes, it's that time of the week, Open Mic Friday, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line, taking your calls with comments, compliments, concerns, general crack pottery. We'll take it all. But before we do, I've got an uplifting story as we head into this Memorial Day weekend and a Father's Day gift recommendation. Charles, which would you like to hear first?
I'd like to hear the uplifting story.
All right. This is a story of Naveen Town. That's the name of this eighth grade kid in a small town in Michigan called Otsego. He started a headstone cleaning business. Yes, a headstone cleaning business as a grade schooler. It's been up and running for a few years. Here's the local news telling Naveen Town's story.
I like cleaning headstones because I get to see the dirty become clean.
When the weather's nice, you can find Naveen Town in a local cemetery, hard at work.
I'm picking out the lichen and moss and lichen in the letters with little toothpicks.
The Otsego eighth grader started Naveen Cleans Headstones a few years ago.
Some last longer than others, but it usually takes around an hour.
When he was working on a family tree project in elementary school and visited his five times great uncle's headstone.
I saw his headstone and I thought no one should have that dirty of a headstone.
Since then, he's cleaned nearly 150 headstones, charging $20 each. And the families of veterans get these services for free.
I've taken classes and I've got certified so that I know I'm cleaning a headstone correctly and that I won't damage the headstone.
Naveen puts away some of his earnings and donates some too. He says he has many satisfied customers.
The people that ask me to clean it can be very happy.
The incoming freshman plans to keep the gig going through high school and urges other kids to pursue their passions.
Anyone can start a business whenever they want to. You just need to have a good idea.
Nice.
Yep, that's a good idea. But yeah. I tell you, I don't know if I want to spend that much time in a cemetery.
It's going to make you a little creepy. Yeah. Well, nice, industrious kid and entrepreneur, so that's all good. In eighth grade, no less, and actually started a few years ago, as was mentioned. And also cleaning the headstones of veterans
that's
for free.
That's yeah. Really wonderful.
That's, I mean, to the civic-minded, too, in addition mm-hmm. to that. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Behold, be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep though poppies grow in Flanders field.
Oh, Charles. My goodness. You remembered it.
Yes, John McRae.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's good, man. I tell
yeah.
you, that's...
Yeah.
You never cease to amaze me.
Well, it's a little hat tip to Naveen Town. Now, just when you are thinking highly of me, I have that Father's Day gift recommendation.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. This comes to us from a similarly industrious young person named Gwyneth Paltrow. You may have heard of her.
Yeah, slightly.
Yeah. She's got this wellness, she calls it, website called Goop. She of the vagina scented candles. That's one of their real breakthrough products.
What?
Yep. You heard me.
What?
For Father's Day, which is just a few weeks away, she recommends, you know, don't give your dad a tie. Give him something that will really touch him. And what will really touch him is this product called Hugo.
Uh-huh.
Hugo is a anal vibrator for dad.
You know, wait, man. I thought this was a vagina-scented candle and a... An anal what?
It's a hands-free toy for prostate stimulation. It's got a powerful vibrating motor with 8 intensity settings. Oh, perfect. As well as an insertable head that delivers satisfying vibrations in the perineum.
Man, that is the absolute worst thing that I have to deal with.
Did I tell you it's water? Did I tell you it's waterproof?
Now waterproof? Are you interested?
Yeah, it's waterproof.
I don't know, man. Between the two, I think I would have to go with the vagina-scented candle.
Yeah, okay. All
right. Depending on the vagina, of course. I mean.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's an excellent point. Anyway, you know, just, you know, want to get people out of their, you know, customs when it comes to Father's Day. You know, just jump with both feet into this brave new world.
If I did anything right this morning, I did the order right. The inspiring story.
Yeah.
And the next one, the other one, the Father's Day story.
Father's Day gift recommendation.
I had them in the right order. I won that one.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably right. All right, let's take some calls. And also, too, if anybody is interested in the Hugo, I'm happy to provide more details. Verlon, Southside, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
How you guys doing?
Hey, good morning.
There's no need to ask. There's no need to ask me. I don't want either. Since reparations was kind of the theme since the beginning of the show, I tried to call in, but it was too late. Okay, I never heard this question means tested. Now, the number of reparations that people have kind of settled on was 1.2 million.
Some people.
And 1.2 million times 48 million black people that were born here comes out to 49.2 trillion. Okay. I got that out of the way. I want this question to be asked to whoever wants reparations. If you want to take this one-time payout, you have to forego all government programs. That means public housing, EBT food stamps, medical, and Social Security. That's off the table if you take this one-time payout. Now, I want people to think about this. You think you can live the rest of your life off $1.2 trillion? You're so happy to get $1 million, you think you're rich? Well, I know a lot of people that came to the nursing home with $1 million, and that $1 million dried up real fast with medical expenses. Mm-hmm. So I think you can do a lot of weeding out if you gave black people the choice, take this one-time payout, or you forgo all those benefits that you're getting from the government. And in the long run, I think we'll save a lot of money. Just try that out. And I want you to do something for me, Dan, because you're good with numbers. Can you add up per person how much housing, EBT, food stamps, and medical is per person? Because, like I said, I think we could save money in the long run.
Thanks for the call, Verlon. Well, I mean, that varies by state to state, depending on the state public support programs. I mean, I remember a Cato Institute study. This is years ago now, maybe a decade, where they did a state-by-state calculation, and some of the states that have bigger public support and more varied public support programs, like, say, Hawaii, you were north of six figures in terms of the you know, actual value of the benefits you were receiving on an annualized basis. And in some smaller states, less population, more conservative, like Wyoming, you were down in, you know, the $30,000, $35,000 range. So I can only imagine what it is today, particularly with the expansion of Medicaid. But yeah, it would be interesting for somebody to do that that green eye shades work on the present value of all the welfare state programs you can access at, you know, simultaneously, depending on, you know, age and size of family and so forth, number of kids and so forth, number of dependents and so forth.
You know, another thing, Dan, the clock is ticking. As the browning of America takes place, pretty soon we're going to be, you know, the demand for reparations is going to be from people who had absolutely nothing to do with slavery or discrimination or anything like that.
Well, yeah.
And who you're going to ask, you know, white people become the minority in America, I think it's by 2040, you're going to be asking everybody else to basically atone for their sins, if you will. I mean, I think that's not to mention the people who immigrated to this country after the end of slavery. I mean, it's so preposterous. Again, it's a political trick to have a discussion. So every time a Democrat congressional candidate comes before the microphone, he or she will be asked, "Do you support reparations?" And they'll say, "Yes." And then the Republicans will say no. And then black people will line up behind the Democrats. It's just a big trick.
Eduardo, Tampa Bay.
Yeah, Dan, went back to Chicago briefly last weekend for the restaurant show at McCormick. They showcased the latest technology for the restaurant industry. And I saw a lot of white and Asian people over there as far as the vendors. So that should be something that we should be barking up here on the U.S. side as far as why aren't there more people educated and showcasing latest technology. But, you know, they're reading at, what, sixth grade level, math skills and all that. So how do you expect them to be out there?
Thanks for the call, Eduardo. I visited Chicago. Eduardo used to be living around Midway. Now he's visiting Chicago from Tampa Bay. Interesting. Ralph and Wilmette.
Hey, good morning. Dan, Charles, great show. Real quick, Dan, the your Father's Day present, that's actually literally the lowest you can go. It's supposed to be reach out and touch someone, not reach in. Anyway, you remember, you've heard the Senator Fetterman's great speech to the bankers. I managed to turn that into a ringtone for my very, very favorite client. So when he's calling, I just let it ring and ring so I can hear Fetterman say, and he says it clear as day. He says, bail out, bail out, sail out, that, blah. And if you can't understand that, well, that's on you. You're just prejudiced.
Very good. Thanks for the call, Ralph. Ron, Southside.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Charles. I was wondering, did the president of NAACP, Derrick Johnson, did he issue a travel advisory for the city of Chicago for this weekend, regardless of your race? But then I realized they doesn't have to because the peacekeepers will be out there.
That's right.
Thank you. to the governor. So everything will be safe, guys. You all just enjoy because the peacekeepers are going to take care of it this weekend. You all have a great weekend there.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Ron. Who protects the peacekeepers is the question. Remember, last Memorial Day, a year ago, 9 murdered, 50 shot, I think. So you can understand why they're trying to at least get ahead of it from a PR perspective and say, we've got all these activities. As we talked about earlier in the show, Brandon Johnson yesterday announcing that he's got a couple hundred community organizations and they're going to have barbecues and three-legged races and horseshoes and all kinds of fun activities for the kids. And that should keep everybody on the straight and narrow, right, Charles?
Oh, silly kids.
Silly kids.
Silly kids. They'll have something to do.
Bob and Wilmette.
Hey, Dan and Charles. Great show as always.
Good morning.
You enlightened me the other day, Dan, with the tuck-friendly apparel at Target.
Yeah.
And did a little research. I assume that's for men, you know, transitioning to women and, you know, tucking the junk so they can feel more, you know, at home in their body. I was a little disappointed, though. I did some research, and there isn't, bulge-friendly apparel at Target for people transitioning the other way. Any insight?
You know, I don't know. You'll have to call Target customer service on that one. That's really beyond my pay grade. Thanks for the question, though, Bob. It's a great one. It's going to be interesting to see if there's a sustained reaction to Target like there was and is to Bud Light. It's going to be very interesting to see because, of course, the Bud Light consumers are men and the Target shoppers generally are women. And so it's just going to be interesting to see if moms take a strident position against Target like former Bud Light drinkers have taken against Anheuser-Busch products. We'll see. Frank, Northwest Side.
Hi, good morning, Dan. How are you? Just wanted to talk about what Brandon Johnson is doing regarding the possible move of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which has been in Chicago since, I believe, 1898. I just wanted to see what your thoughts are on that because there's a lot of income coming from there, and if they leave, where are they going to get the income?
Yeah, thanks for the call, Frank. I mean, so Terry Duffy, the CEO of the CME Group, has basically said, you know, if they do these things, like if the they can't do it at the city level. If the city moved to have their fellow travelers in Springfield impose a transaction tax on the exchanges, then they're gone. That's basically what Terry Duffy said. So it's an if. It's not we're going to. It's an if they do things like that. But, you know, I just wonder if it really requires that to pull up stakes. I mean, certainly it didn't for Ken Griffin and many others. I know this would be a specific tax targeted at the exchanges, so it's a bit different. But even still, a headcount tax, like has been proposed, at 8 times the previous headcount tax. You know, depending on what they do, I think you're going to have a lot of business. I mean, businesses are already evaluating whether or not they're going to stay, or if they're going to stay, whether or not they're going to expand here or somewhere else if they have multiple locations. And so I'm sure people are watching very closely to see where Brandon Johnson goes with all of the various tax increases he's proposed, and so have his allies.
And you know, his allies, Dan, have been talking about many of these taxes, if you will, this redistribution of the wealth. They've been talking about it for 20 years.
Yeah,
I can't believe they've all of a sudden going to back off to play a middle position. I mean, these people are thoroughly committed to getting the money first, if you will. Let's get the money. Is that what they're calling it?
Yeah, first we get the money. It's Tony Montana time in Chicago.
They're going to get they want the money. And the mayor is going to have to say, hold on, guys, wait. No, these people want the money. This is their shot. They've worked on it for the past 20, 25 years. And it's a huge division within the Brandon Johnson camp at this point.
And when we say the money, you know, just to be clear, your money.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Rick, Downers Grove.
Hey, good morning. Hey, back on Monday, you were talking about like the Dodgers and that one trans group, whatever it was, Sisters of Perpetual Stupidity or whatever they want to put on their trans show.
Right.
And we were talking about, I thought that this movement should be able to burn itself out pretty quick. And you said it might be take a little bit longer. But I believe that these CEOs, these groups look for a reaction. And the bigger the negative reaction, the better they like it. And if these CEOs would stand up to them, and these schools would stand up to them and say, no, you're not going to do your show, and that's it, and don't back down, I believe that these groups would lose interest in doing that faster than I lost interest in soccer.
Well, let me tell you, I worked in San Francisco from 1978 to 1982. And one of the groups that was very prominent in San Francisco in those days, it's 42 years ago, 45 years ago, the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence.
That's who they are.
They were there 40 years ago, and I don't think they're... If anything, the Dodgers gave them a big boost because they've been around for a minute.
Yeah, no question. And by the way, to the extent you think, oh, this is going to burn out, I won't get too deep into it, but I would direct your attention to the recent ad campaign from North Face, you know, the outdoor clother. As well as Calvin Klein, the new underwear ad featuring a couple of fat people, including one fat dude wearing some kind of sports bra. If you think the Dylan Mulvaney and a sports bra for that Nike was offensive, wait till you see the new Calvin Klein ad. It's certainly not the Brooke Shields era of nothing gets between me and my Calvin Kleins. Wasn't she Calvin Klein back in the day? Yeah, anyway.
I won't be looking for it, man.
I've
seen enough.
Right, but I mean, it's going to burn out. Well, it's going to spread like a prairie fire before it does, if it does. I'm not sure it does. Jim, South Elgin.
Good morning, gents. Good show. You know, before I talk about all the abuses of the government, you know, the FBI is refusing congressional subpoenas. So why can't Congress today, under control of Republicans, pull the funding for the FBI and close them down?
Well, yeah, thanks for the call, Jim. I mean, you're not going to get that signed off on by Biden, and I don't think they want to go that far that fast. But certainly with respect to the subpoenas, House Oversight Committee Chairman Jim Comer has said he is going to move contempt charges against Christopher Wray specifically if he doesn't comply with a document that he's requested, unclassified document he's requested that the FBI is slow walking relating to allegations by a whistleblower that the big guy, Mr. 10%, was bribed by a foreign official. So we'll see. We'll see how aggressive House Republicans want to get and how fast. Chuck and Delavan to close it out.
Hey, great show. Great show. Holy smokes, it's summertime. My white pants are back out of the closet and since Labor Day. And my saddle shoes are out, too, and my Don Ho Hawaiian shirt. To kick off the big show tonight, go to see Sarah Teal, who sings better than Janis Joplin, at the Geneva Tap Room. D-Light Duo tomorrow night at Abbey. And if you want to catch me on Sunday to see Phil Cockins, I'll be at DJ's in a Drink. Everybody have a great weekend and enjoy yourself. It's summertime.
This message brought to you by Chuck and Delavan.
Thanks for the call. And you know, I mean, yeah, did we say DJs on Sunday if you want to see Chuck in his tight white pants? Who doesn't? All right, actually, we're going to close it out with this on this special weekend with Rich in Indian Head Park. Hey, Rich.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Yeah, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning.
What I wanted you to ask, Dan, is for everyone out there to say a prayer for all our veterans, men and women, who lost their lives to defend the country and to give us the freedoms that we have today. You guys have a nice weekend and be safe.
Amen. Thanks for the call, Rich. Dan and Charles Thomas in for Amy J.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.